Tired of sugar-coated news and corporate spin? Check out The Nicole Sandler Show, speaking truth to power with the irreverence it deserves. Smart, fearless, and just the right amount of snark, Nicole breaks down the headlines, exposes the hypocrisy, and talks with the people working for real change. Weekdays at 3 Eastern, noon Pacific on Progressive Voices, NicoleSandler.com, Substack, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't just get the news, get the truth.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein, and this is Spy Talk.
Former aide to Governor Hochul and former Governor Cuomo charged tonight with acting as an illegal agent to the Chinese government and the Chinese Communist Party.
The indictment, more than 60 pages long, alleging she and her husband gained millions of dollars in financial benefits to buy luxury properties and fancy cars.
Here we go again. That was CBS New York's report on yet another alleged Chinese secret agent uncovered and arrested. In this latest case, a couple who insinuated themselves into senior circles of two successive New York governors, first Andrew Cuomo and then his successor, Kathy Hochul. Over a period of roughly 14 years, according to the feds, Linda's son rose through the ranks to become deputy chief of staff to Governor Hochul before she was fired for unspecified reasons and became a target of federal investigators. But according to the DOJ, the 41-year-old was secretly using her position to advance Chinese political and business interests and steal relevant documents. In return, the feds say Beijing's spy service showered the couple with millions of dollars and afforded them lavish homes, a Ferrari, Roma sports car, and people had fun with this, special salted duck dishes prepared by a Chinese embassy chef. In court on Tuesday, the couple entered not guilty pleas to charges of acting as unregistered foreign agents and other charges. One person who's absolutely not surprised by all this is Nicholas F. Timiades, who became a leading expert on Chinese espionage over his 34-year government career, which included work for the CIA, the State Department's Bureau of Diplomatic Security, and as senior intelligence officer in the Defense Intelligence Agency. Today, he teaches at Penn State and is a senior fellow with the Atlanta Council's Scowcroft Center for Strategy and Security. He is also the author of Chinese Intelligence Operations, a 1994 groundbreaking book, which will soon be issued with an update. China's MSS security agency, of course, couldn't care less about which party or levels of U.S. government infiltrates. Its goal is to weaken the United States by any means necessary. Nick F. Timiades, welcome back to Spy Talk. We're going to talk Chinese espionage, of course, because you're the guy who keeps track of this, sleeps at 24/7. What's going on with these arrests in New York? You wrote on LinkedIn via another webpage you have that there's a new turn in Chinese espionage that began around 2019. But some days it just seems we're being swarmed by Chinese agents. FBI Director Wray famously said in 2022 that he's opening a new counter-espionage, Chinese counter-espionage case every 12 hours. How can we keep up with it? And are we being swarmed by Chinese agents?
Well, no question we are. I disagree with the FBI on their approach. And actually, when you talk to the agents, they disagree with the approach. They just feel powerless to do anything about it.
Well, let's stop right there. What do you mean by that?
Well, I point out, you know, your own director, the Director Wray, said you have a new case once every 12 hours. Two a day times 365, that's 730 cases a year, spread over 56 field offices. And each one could take months to resolve.
Exactly.
You're immediately thousands of cases in arrears. You cannot arrest your way out of this situation.
Well, is he right that the assault by Chinese espionage is requiring two cases to be opened every 12 hours? What is that? Or is that scare tactics on his part?
No.
Untangle that.
You know what? Let's take, and I did mention that in 2019, we started to see a shift in the focus of China's covert influence activities. And they wrote about this actually in a think tank, which was like the People's Intelligence, you know, something or other think tank, in accordance, working with Tsinghua University. We're working for the United Front Work Department, and they published a report on it. And they said, as the opinion in Washington hardens against us, we have to shift focus to the states and cities, right? This is what they wrote, mm-hmm. what the plan was. And we've seen a clear shift into the states and the cities and attempts at covert influence in those areas. And this case with, you know, with Linda Sun is a classic example of it. And the difference now is that the FBI is actually taking this seriously and working against it.
Well, let me just circle back to this thing again about two new cases every day. What does that mean? Is that BS, scare tactics on Director Ray's part, or is that a figure that exists in reality?
No, I believe it's a figure that exists in reality. Look, I have over 840 cases logged. And I mean, I'm sure I get just the tip of the iceberg. And I have details on if I have details on 840 cases, I mean, you can only imagine how many actually are in play. And but when we say this, let's be clear. We're talking about what we would call covert action or covert influence, foreign agents registration. We're talking about economic espionage. We are talking about illegal exports of technology, ITAR and EAR violations in the United States, and we're talking about bona fide espionage. So it's not just, you know, what we have traditionally called espionage in the U.S. intelligence community. It's a wide range of illegal activities being done by the Chinese or with support of the Chinese government.
Let me ask you this, Nick, in the espionage sector, what is it that the Chinese are doing here that we don't try to do in China? We have trumpeted our shift to China, so to speak, our interest in China. There have been arrests of reported arrests of CIA assets, many of them in China. So we're trying to spy on them and get into their pants, so to speak. So what's different? I mean, isn't this just traditional great power behavior?
Espionage is. Yes, not only great power behavior, but just about every country's behavior. You know, I always like to point out the Vatican has an intelligence service, and they do collecting.
It's called the second oldest profession.
Right. For a reason, it is. And so, I mean, that part is not unusual.
So it's the same in terms of the espionage. We're trying to recruit secret agents among the Chinese in the Chinese government, and they're trying to recruit agents here.
Right.
But, it's different. But what you're saying.
Let's start out with just the espionage slice.
Sure.
Just the espionage slice. The difference is the volume. For example, approaches and actual successful recruitments on LinkedIn. You know, the Germans reported 10,000 in Germany. The French reported 9,000 approaches and people giving information to China on LinkedIn. And the Brits reported 20,000. So, I mean, China has, and they do it. They're brilliant in a sense. I mean, they find the people who need the money. They, you know, they start with this process of give us papers, unclassified papers. Then they push with more money for more what they call, you know, non-public information. And we've had a number of cases in the U.S. where that has been effective.
So, on LinkedIn, they do it using false identities, false fronts. Right,
absolutely. They frequently use covers of think tanks or private research firms to approach people.
So, and we know because of prosecutions, we know the MO, the standard MO, which is the Chinese think tank asks contracts with an American scholar. Somebody needs money, some student says, we'd like you to do some simple research for us. It's very innocuous kind of subjects and research. And then the subjects get more and more sensitive until they get to something that's clearly illegal. And they've identified the needs of their target, say money, especially with a young person who was arrested, I think in Hong Kong a few years ago, just got drawn in by the money.
Right.
And that's Schultz, standard technique.
That Corbin Schultz was communicating with someone he believed was in a think tank in Hong Kong. and fell down that trap. But this is relatively new. This is 2017, started with Kevin Mallory, recruited on LinkedIn. And since that time, the tradecraft has changed to that being the front line of how China does business. In addition to that, and you can see a pattern as they go along with that individual of increasing operation security, OPSEC, right? Mm-hmm. So they're moving from open communications to commercial encryption, you know, WeChat or Telegram. Telegram is Russian owned, so there's no possibility of getting a warrant to get information out of it. So they're moving through those selective areas of operation security that they're instructing the individual. You know, don't put any biomarkers in your phone, no thumbprints or, you know, or facial recognition or things like that. Get a separate cell phone for this, which we will pay for. You know, all these operation security measures come into being until they get to a point where now we've seen for bona fide espionage, you know, somewhere where they're getting classified information, they're setting up encrypted websites or they're using designed MSS software to make those communications. No more commercial encryption. So it's a progression.
You say you compiled some 850 or whatever it was, number of cases on your own. And I want to talk about your new company that helps identify these operations and helps advise state, local, municipal police, and maybe the feds as well. So does that mean that the feds have some 850 open cases of Chinese espionage or influence wielding right now?
No, it does not. My cases, number one, are worldwide. So I have cases from France, from England, from Germany. I was just with Estonia, and I've talked to several of those governments about those cases. So I have unique and detailed information about that. Our system, example, just inside ball, I've gotten questions from FBI analysts about specific cases. And I'm, wait, you guys did this case. Why are you asking me about it? And they say, Nick, that's another section. And they don't share the information with us. And so if you can imagine that existing within the FBI, then add CIA, Department of Commerce, Department of Homeland Security, and you get to understand the complexities. Each one has some understanding of their own cases in depth, in great depth, but they can't look across the board on hundreds of cases and say, oh, we see the same type of tradecraft applied against this technology or in this type of case. Just because they're not sharing, they don't have that.
Mm. And these cases are very, very sensitive. This is really family jewel stuff, mm-hmm. counter-espionage cases against any foreign espionage service. And it would be very, very closely held at FBI, CIA, Commerce, wherever. So there's just the way the system is built in, there would be a lack of coordination between these agencies. Is there a lack of coordination?
Yes, I mean, so. You know, there's a lack of coordination. B, perhaps even more importantly, there is a lack of strategic thought on this, right? The FBI might share with Homeland Security or Department of Commerce relative to specific cases. Of course, they do. In that sense, on a tactical and operational level, the sharing is reasonably good. Where it doesn't get good is everyone deciding, what do we do about this? How do we affect deterrence? How do we deal with this on a strategic level and get out of this mentality of case by case by case? You know, we're going to try and address it because we don't have the resources. Nobody does to address it at that level.
And you have to understand something about China, in other words, to pursue these cases effectively. And that's not so simple. I mean, the tapestry of Chinese history is so interesting, as you know, that they're going to have their own particular methodology and tradecraft that is beyond the ken of an ordinary FBI agent. He has no clue to what's going on here, what he sees. I mean, if someone calls into the FBI, Professor so-and-so at the Confucius Institute at this university, I suspect him of something. And it could be total false report, paranoia, whatever, but your average FBI agent has a difficulty in fielding that kind of issue.
Yeah, no, you're 100% right. I mean, to date, I've trained over 1,000 U.S. counterintelligence officers, right? So I'm training them and equally as many in private industry. And what you find is just a lack of cultural understanding and the lack of how the Chinese system works. It's a Confucian, humanistic-based society, which is dramatically different from the legalistic, individualist society that we have. I mean, it's really a night and day. So if you don't understand how that society works and how to function within it, it really makes it very, very difficult to go after the Foreign Intelligence Service. And yeah, and the language is yet another barrier. And we call it, you know, China's first level of encryption is the language. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, between those two components, a lack of cultural awareness and understanding, plus the lack of language, I mean, we're truth be told, we're getting clobbered.
Right. And Confucian traditions with the overlay of communist control are very powerful. I'm thinking of the case of the fellow in New York who was actually a democracy activist. He was arrested during the Tiananmen student uprising and massacre, came to the United States and joined human rights groups. And then one day he got, you know, interested in going back and seeing his family. On the mainland, and that's where the MSS, Chinese intelligence, caught up to him and coerced him into infiltrating these groups, reporting on the groups that he was very much involved with.
Right, and he was one of the more outstanding activists, democracy advocates, Tang, this is we're talking about, and an understanding of that system is that he started to travel to first Korea, and then from Korea to China, and then from Taiwan to Macau, and then Taiwan to Macau again, each time hiding the fact that he was going to China, right? So no direct flights, because immediately people would pick up on that. The activists started suspecting him when he started not being critical of the PRC, and he was taking these flights to Asia. And they're like, well, why was he going to Korea? So, you know, that started raising the flag. But anyone who knows that system knows, okay, if he wants to go back home, he's not doing it unless he has government approval. And being on a wanted list, sure, right? It was pretty obvious as to what he was doing.
Right. And that's pretty subtle stuff. I mean, it required a lot of tradecraft for eluding surveillance and so on. But let's talk about something else, much more overt. And it's really sort of striking that the Chinese would do this. The Washington Post today published on page one and continuing into full pages inside, its investigation into China's harassment of activists here when Xi Jinping visited San Francisco. They roughed up pro-democracy groups and Tibet groups and so on, and they were quite overt about it. The Washington Post collected videos and extensive interviews to establish the facts of this. I mean, that's pretty bold.
I'll tell you something that hasn't become public. That
let's hear it. We like news.
Yeah. In the case of Wang Shujun, right? Another democracy advocate who was termed by the MSS and has been reporting to them for over 10 years. Okay. In New York City, same thing. And he was just convicted a month ago. Okay. In that case, just before the proceeding started on day three, the judge called over the prosecuting attorney and the defense attorney and one of the jurors, female Chinese American, who asked to be relieved from jury duty because she feared for her family and part of her family in Taiwan. Mm. So, think about this. The reach of the Chinese government or the CCP is so frightening to people that, you know, 7,000 miles away in the U.S., they say, I don't want to serve on this jury because it puts my family in jeopardy.
I first reported on such activities back in, it had to be at least 15 years ago. When I was a congressional quarterly, I interviewed a prominent Uyghur exile in the Washington suburbs. And she told me, she gave me very detailed descriptions of the harassment she was receiving. Cars following her very blatantly, cutting her off in traffic, sending her warnings to stand down and stop criticizing China. Very overt.
Right.
That was at least 15 years ago that I reported that. And that's been going on for a long time. Why? why stop now? That?
Right. I actually, I saw this in the 1980s when I lived in Chinatown in Washington, D.C. I had come back from living in Taiwan, late 80s. I was living in Chinatown. And you could see this occurring. You could talk to people and they would talk in hushed tones, but it was occurring. So the question is, why now? And it is a Department of Justice shift over the last 2 years in what they're addressing. And that individual, Wang Shujun, who I mentioned, and the media portrays as a scholar who was working on behalf of the Ministry of State Security. His case was initially reported to the Bureau in 2010 because I spoke to dissidents who, you know, who actually paid for him to go and to have democracy discussions. He disappeared in China for a month, came back with no explanations. They fired him. The company fired him and reported it to the FBI. Nothing done. Nothing done for over 10 years. And it's just...
How come?
Well, because the FBI didn't have an interest in it. And, you know, truth be told, when you're in front of a prosecutor and you have either a terrorist or multiple kilos of cocaine or a guy who you're going to put an investigation and who might have been harassing dissidents on the part of the Chinese government, they select the terrorist and the cocaine first.
We have to take a short break. Okay, we're back. Let's circle back to this case of the two Chinese agents that infiltrated the staffs of Governor Cuomo and Governor Hochul. Mm-hmm. So is that unprecedented, that level of penetration?
No, we've seen that level of penetration in Congress. We've seen that level of penetration in different venues and different places in police departments. We've seen it there. So the level, maybe the amount of wealth they acquired, brilliant. I mean, I give them credit. They really worked the system with the PRC to for the husband to make a lot of money with that. Maybe it is in the fact that they were at a governor's level. And the impact was so far looking pretty, pretty strong. So, I mean, but, you know, the PRC made this a note that they were going to do this. And this has happened, you know, multiple types of places. You hear whispers and reporting and discussing about it.
Well, what can we do? I mean, it just seems, again, this goes back to the beginning. We just seem to be overwhelmed by these cases. It seems like the Chinese have adapted an espionage version of their infantry tactics that we saw in Korea during the Korean War. They're swarming, overwhelming, underarmed, but overwhelming U.S. troops and South Korean troops in 1950, 51, 52 in Korea. Is that what they're doing here? Just flood the zone, so to speak?
Well, I think it's a little more sophisticated than that. Mm-hmm. In 1999, two Chinese senior colonels or general officers came out with a book called Unrestricted Warfare. And in this book, they examined the U.S. warfare in Iraq, right? You know, the campaign in Iraq. And what they come to the conclusion of is saying the U.S. is a victim of its own success. It's like the British longbow. You know, they have technology and warfare. So every fight they have, they go looking for the type of fight that they can apply their strengths. Meanwhile, their economy is open. Their social structure is completely open. Their political process is completely open.
Ours.
Yeah, ours is. You know, they advocate drug warfare. They advocate smuggling warfare. You know, and I don't know if you know, but we have $1 trillion worth of illegal intellectual property, you know, coming into the United States, 87% of which from China, you know, double the size of the global drug trade. You know, we have China supporting or at least turning a blind eye to fentanyl, fentanyl production and coming into the United States. So China's taking a total warfare approach or an unrestricted warfare approach. And this is part of it. And our democracy is not set up. Our federal agencies are just not structured to deal with it.
They have a big advantage over us because there is a state communist party controlled society, and we don't have the freedom to operate in China that they have. Right. They have here. Now, going back to that warfare argument of several years ago, if memory serves me, that was rejected by party leaders back then. So. They've circled back and said, "Well, maybe, now we're ready to do that."
Actually, to be clear, publicly it was rejected. They did take on, openly, they took on the three warfares that they called in 2003. The Central Military Commission accepted three of the warfares stated there. And the other, you know, they're not going to publicly accept drug warfare. So yet nonetheless, we see it. And or, you know, smuggling warfare, yet nonetheless, we see it. Trade warfare, and we see it. So, you know, they talk about using tourists as a weapon, you know, for stopping tourists from going to a particular country to crush that economy. We see that throughout the South Pacific Islands, threats against South Korea that way, threats against Lithuania that way. So, you know, the Chinese.
What do you mean by the use of tourists here?
So, example, in Cambodia and, you know, and the South Pacific Islands, Chinese companies with the government support and approval lend those countries under Belt and Road Initiative a lot of money to build hotels and tourism and ports and things. And the Chinese tourists, particularly when there's gambling involved, as we've seen in Laos and Burma and other places, come flooding in, you know, and really bolster that economy. And then if the country doesn't vote with the PRC, doesn't support the PRC in any political dimension, China cuts tourism. No more tourists. Now, the country still owes China the money for building all the hotels, for building all the infrastructure, the roads and the ports and things like that. They just don't realize the money anymore because China's cut the tourism. It's a form of trade.
Partly our own fault.
Yeah, well, it's
partly our own fault. We didn't pay attention to the Solomon Islands, the other island nations, the emerging nations. As the years went by, neither did Australia. We thought, oh, well, you know, they're kind of ours, so we don't have to worry about them. And the Chinese just crept up on that. I want to swing back before we
But by
leave,
the way, you also see this with South Korea and other places that China uses. South Korea got the THAAD radar systems, and China cut all imports from South Korea. Every one of them, they didn't actually technically cut them. They all had investigations done on the companies. And, you know, their factories inside China were closed down while these investigations happened. And they cut tourism going to South Korea. So a big hit to the South Korean economy for accepting a U.S. radar system. This is the type of warfare they engage in.
And meanwhile, they're stealing our technology blind. I mean, no one could miss the incredible similarity between Chinese jets, transport jets and fighters and ours. So they've done a good job infiltrating Boeing. Well, you can have Boeing as far as I'm concerned. But, I mean, maybe their planes will start falling out of the sky or their doors popping off soon. Anyway, but let's swing back before we close. I want to talk about this new Justice Department initiative again. Can you, what's the scale of that, the breadth of that, and does that even put us in competition to shut these guys down?
Well, it makes it more dangerous for them. You know, there are a lot of areas to go to. This is a I don't know how to say it other than a grand penetration. I mean, you have organizations that are blatantly reporting to the Chinese government, the Chinese Scholars and Students Association. You know, you look on the website and that all the positions in there are approved by the Chinese consulate, they say. So there are a lot, you know, it's pervasive in academia, in these associations that exist that work and support the United Front Work Department. In the U.S. alone, we've identified over 600 of those types of associations, 600 associations, right? Do the math, thousands and thousands of people. So it's a big haul. It's a big deal. That in itself, arresting people, as we've done now, is not the answer. You know, it's got to be a strategic approach. When this happens, you have to do something back to China to enforce deterrence.
So I would think that part of our strategic approach has to be infiltrating Chinese intelligence at the highest levels, Chinese foreign ministry, Chinese industrial apparatus. We have to infiltrate them and create some problems for them so that they know that they don't have a free hand anymore.
The best defense is a good offense.
Let me ask one final thing here about how they operate here. Now, the CIA and other Western intelligence services have station chiefs in various countries. And even in the countries of our antagonists, we're declared to each other. The Chinese know who the CIA station chief is in Beijing, for example, because they kind of have to deal with it from time to time. The same with the FBI's, the LEGAT representative in Beijing and in other consulates in China. China declare its station chief in at the Chinese embassy in Washington has to be known. sure. and deal with CIA and so on. Mm-hmm. But do they also have a black station here and around the country? Black stations, which means to say deep cover stations here. And a spy chief, a Chinese spy chief is running those operations, or is that run out of Beijing?
So that's an interesting question. But let me slice it a bit. When you say black stations, do you mean black stations that are outside the embassy?
That's right.
The people that are undeclared, certainly, right? And that's not unusual for any place globally, right? They'll have people that are declared to the host government and people that are not. That's mm-hmm. norm for any country. Right. In this case, do they have people that operate without the embassy knowing? The evidence would suggest yes, because China very much has a linear form of control. We've seen both. We've seen control in the United States by Chinese, quote, consular officials, right? MSS officers. We've seen a number of cases of that. But more often, particularly in all the other worlds like economic espionage and covert influence, we see a direct line to the United Front Work Department or the Ministry of State Security in China.
Cutouts.
And that's done for security purposes. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a VFR linear link.
Let me ask you this. Why don't we name and shame the chief of Chinese intelligence at the Chinese embassy in Washington, D.C.?
Well, because they would do the same to us. And that's not how diplomacy is played. But B, I mean, we have name and shame. They're cyber criminals. The FBI wanted list has a cyber wanted list, and probably 9 out of the 10 on it are Chinese. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, how crazy it was, but people were using that in security companies in China as a basis to go out and get business. Look, the West is mad at us because we've hacked them and blah, blah, blah. We're the best in security. I've watched this on Chinese TV. People bragging about how they did denial of service attacks against companies in the U.S. or Australia and using that to get business inside China as a computer security company. Crazy as it is.
We have to – no, crazy. If you're a spy master, that's good stuff. Now, there's got to be lots of Chinese secret agents that are under diplomatic cover in the United States, as are Russian agents. So we regularly expelled in European countries have regularly expelled Russian intelligence officers. Why aren't we doing the same in the United States and Western Europe? Is it because we don't want to have our agents, our few effective agents in Beijing and Shanghai or wherever, expelled? Is that it?
For two reasons. Number one, remember that most of their operations are run from China direct, right? So the asset is in touch with someone in China. And the reason they do this is not to put their case officers in jeopardy. So that's reason number one. Reason number two, we have taken actions like that. We closed down the Houston consulate for that reason. Mm-hmm. Right?
That's true.
An entire frigging consulate. So, which just leads to retaliation. They run a tremendous risk. The FBI is very good at its job when you want to talk about going after people on the ground. So they run a great risk, and they know that. They have tons of rules and regulations for assets that they have in the U.S. on communications and such, specifically because they're afraid of the FBI. This movement towards LinkedIn and online, online recruitments and going back, this is all because of U.S. counterintelligence, right? They've adapted and found a way forward. And they're still in China and they're safe. So we have to find other means to make it costly to them. Oh,
I wonder if they use shortwave radio like the Cuban agents were discovered doing. The Annie Montes case, for example, she just listens to a series of numbers, coded messages over shortwave radio. It was really old fashioned stuff. I wonder if the Chinese do the same.
They do the same, but not targeted towards the U.S. And the reason I know they do the same is that you can go online in YouTube and there are groups that I've been in contact with and talked to that collect those broadcasts. And they're in different locations and they triangulate the broadcast, a shortwave broadcast, and they triangulate them to coming out of China. But those, I think, are more directed towards Southeast Asia, towards assets in Southeast Asia or Taiwan. So we definitely see that happening. But, it's not going to be done in the United States. We'll see what happens as they advance in Cuba.
we've been talking about this for years, you and I, Nick, and I suspect that this won't be the last time. This problem is certainly not going to go away. So we'll have you back on the next time there's a big Chinese espionage arrest.
Well, I look forward to it. But if that's the case, you'll have me probably on weekly or monthly at the work.
Could do that. Thanks, Nick. Appreciate it.
Pleasure to be here, as always.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Thanks much for listening. By the way, you can find lots more interesting conversations like this one in our archives, available at our home at the MSW Network or on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, mosey on over to our Spy Talk newsletter on Substack, where my colleagues and I offer fresh reporting and analyses from the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll find your way there. All that music you've been hearing is from M. Butterfly, the 1988 play and later film that portrays the seduction of a minor French diplomat by a Beijing opera diva, who actually is a man, to spy on France for China. Seems like there's nothing new under the sun. That's it. I'm Jeff Stein. See you around.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
It's no surprise that newsmakers try to manipulate the audience. They want you to believe that they are the one holding the line, and they'll use any trick they can to get you there. But don't let them fool you. Get unspun. I'm Amanda Sturgill. I've been a reporter, and today I teach future reporters to cut the spin and think critically about what newsmakers say. My podcast, Unspun, shows you how to know when you're being manipulated by the news. Learn to spot the tricks and how to make up your own mind about what's true. So if you're tired of being fooled by the news, subscribe to Unspun today. Unspun, because you deserve the truth.